Thank you for attending the session 121 titled The Wicked Son, My Father is Warren Jeffs, presented by Roy Jeffs. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. The Q&A session will be 10 minutes at the end. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon. Who gets to carry that label? What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We don't like labels because the reality is there are as many labels as there are people. Which is why you'll see that in your name badge sleeve, we have allowed you a label to label yourself the kind of Mormon you are or want to be. If you haven't yet, you are welcome to grab a Sharpie from the front desk and help disrupt the narrative of the one true Mormon, and instead tell us who you really are. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase the audio after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skullcandy official headphones by customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is it's going to be less than 60 minutes. And we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparing for the next session. A little about this session. Roy Jeffs is the son of the infamous FLDS prophet Warren Jeffs. Join him as he shares his harrowing story of shame, escape, and resiliency. Roy Jeffs was born into the FLDS faith and is the son of FLDS prophet Warren Jeffs. He lived for 21 years as a faithful member until he left the group in 2014. He now works as a rideshare driver here in Salt Lake City. We will now turn the time over to Roy.
Thank you. So, I didn't come with a specific prepared script and speech because I feel like it's more authentic and I feel like it's more true to myself to speak out what I feel. And I just want to basically share my story of growing up in a polygamous group which turned into a cult when my dad took over. But I just want to share my story of that and then my transition, because I feel like a lot of the most important things in my life have happened since I left that religion and church. And so I want to make sure that everyone here knows that what I say here is my view and my opinion, and it's something that's related to the way you feel about polygamy or the LDS Church or any type of Mormon. I'm not trying to marginalize you at all. That's just my speech or my talk here will basically be my personal views on my experience. So I don't want to feel like any. I just want everybody to make sure they don't feel marginalized. Since we're starting a little late, I'll just get right into it. I was born here in Sandy, or in Salt Lake Valley in Sandy, Utah, up at the mouth of Little Cottonwood Canyon in the old Jeff's house that used to stand up there that's been now taken down. But I was born in 1992 to Gloria Venice Barlow and Warren Steve Jeffs. My first experiences in life, some of my earliest memories, there were some tragic ones and some happy ones as well. I can remember, waking up early in the morning in the summer and going with my dad up the canyon. We'd go hiking up Little Cottonwood Canyon. There was a mountain up there we called Mount Baldy for whatever reason. And those are some of the good memories I had. And I do want to stress that there is a lot of good that I did experience. And I don't want to give the impression that, you know, my life before I left was completely horrible, even though it was in a lot of ways. It wasn't. There were still some very good experiences and memories that I've had. We grew up working very hard. As I said, it was my earliest memories. The enjoyable memories I had is were getting up early in the morning, weeding the garden with my dad, going hiking. I never was able to develop a relationship with my dad specifically, like a one-on-one relationship. So I don't have a lot of one-on-one memories with him. I can remember maybe twice being with him, going to a donut shop, get raspberry filled donuts and shoelaces. And then he would also take me to the high school, the Jeffs or the Alta Academy, to get my haircut, because I was a boy that the high school girls would train on. So those were some of my only times that I was ever with my dad. And I always loved being with the family. We would go to my Uncle Wallace's, Wallace Jeff's. He had a pool. Some of my earliest memories are very fond of that. By the time I was six, the work, I think it was 1997, we'd found out that the Olympics were going to be moving to, or coming to Utah. And my grandpa, who was the leader of the church at the time, for some reason decided that was the turning point, that the Salt Lake Valley was, Salt Lake Valley had become turned over to Satan, I guess. I don't know. It was cursed. He told us it was going to get flooded and all kinds of crazy things. So he had my dad at this point had become first counselor to my grandpa, which made a lot of other people that had been in the church. It made them very jealous because they had been, spent their lives in the church, and my dad was barely in his late 30s. And he was able to capitalize on having the favor of my grandpa. And so we moved down to Short Creek. And that was when it finally our family finally started getting a lot of we became a very structured family at that point. It felt like my earliest memories and the way my life kind of went, because there's phases to me is what it felt like, and a lot of these memories I've had to dig up because my only way to cope was to forget about them. But the phases in my life basically felt like what it was like the first part of my life up in Salt Lake. There's a little bit of light, but in my mind it just feels like a dark time. When we went to Short Creek, that's when my dad set up a very structured household. Of course, he got plenty of more wives down there, but she had about 25 by the time my grandpa died. But shortly after we moved down to Short Creek, my mom was pregnant with my youngest brother at the time, and she had to come back up here to Salt Lake because that was where the midwife, the church midwife, I guess, was based. It was still up here in Salt Lake. And that was my first experience of separation from my mom. There was, like, I had a very, very deep love for my mom, which, you know, I never was able to develop that with my dad. But with my mom, I mean, I can remember back in when I was maybe 4 years old, sneaking in the back of her car. Because she worked at one of the church's construction companies, doing their accounting. And I can remember sneaking in the back of her car and riding with her to work. It was a product of my separation anxiety as a four-year-old. I was almost to work, she heard a noise in the back of the car. And I got in trouble for it, but it was worth it. It was worth it to me because, I don't know, I was my mom's first child, first son, and it felt like at a very young age I had a very deep connection with her. And speaking with my sisters, they told me that from a young age, from the time I was just a small kid, for some reason my dad took a great disliking to me. And he would tell my mom from the time I was, you know, walking around as a toddler, you know, carrying my blanket around the house, like he would tell her, you know, you can't carry that blanket for no reason. And he would also tell her, your son's going to be a failure. He's going to grow up and leave the priesthood if you don't raise him right. And this is the mentality I had all of my life. Was I'm a failure. I never can remember a time that I didn't think that I wasn't a failure. That I was, that at some point, I was always at a great risk of, you know, being destroyed in the judgments, in the destructions which we were told were going to come in the year 2000. And I can remember dreading the year 2002, I guess, but then one or two. When I turned 8 years old, I dreaded that because we were always taught that, or I guess it would have been 2000, sorry, my math is off today. I dreaded turning 8 years old because we were taught that anybody 8 years old and younger had a free pass into heaven. And at a young age, my nightmares were not about monsters or anything else. My nightmares were about I don't know if any of you have been to Short Creek and seen El Capitan up there. It's a big, massive rock formation. Very beautiful. But my nightmares at the time were of mountains falling over and destructions happening and me being left behind and not being able to find my parents or my brothers and sisters. Because that's what was ingrained in us from the youngest age as a kid. That's what was constantly drilled into our minds, that this was going to happen and we had to be prepared for it, and it was going to happen by the year 2000. So when I turned, I can remember the night of December 31st, 1999. I was pretty terrified. Till morning I was very confused that I wasn't dead. Makes a lot of sense. Very positive. But then I turned 8, and I was like, "Well, there goes my free pass." You know, I wanted the destructions to happen. I didn't want them to happen, but I did want them to happen in a way, because I wanted to get done and over with, so I could get to heaven before I turned 8. So that's kind of the mentality we had as a child. And it is amusing for me to look back, but it was very serious. My mom came up here when I was a kid. She came up here. My brother, she was pregnant with my youngest brother. That was my first experience with separation from her. Which I think that by the time that she got back there, I think it rooted in me an even deeper love for her. But that was at that point. I'm a kid, so I wasn't privy to all of these conversations. But my sisters, I've talked a lot to them. They told me about what my dad told her after she had my youngest brother. Said that my dad told her she was no longer worthy to have children. And you could tell by someone's worthiness by how many children they had. My mom had 4, and most of the other mothers that my dad favored had at least, 10 or 12. So he told her they were no longer, or she was no longer allowed to have children because she was not worthy. And looking back on my mom's relationship with my dad, I never once saw any sort of romantic relationship between the two. She gave her life for my dad, and from what my sisters tell me as a kid, he was harping on her constantly, telling her to change who she was or I was going to be a failure. And using me against her way of life and her approach raising children. And after my mom got back from Salt Lake City, it started to brighten up a bit. That's where I started doing a lot of work one-on-one with my mom. There may have been some of you that have been to the house down there in Short Creek. That was her job, and my job was to do the landscaping down there, and it used to look very beautiful. We spent a lot of time at the nurseries in town and a lot of time fixing sprinklers, and our whole job was maintaining the house. And I learned a lot of mechanical skills from her, and I feel like my bond with her grew deeper than most of my brothers and sisters were allowed, because my dad tried in most ways to get children separated from their mothers as soon as possible, so that they didn't grow or they didn't have that attachment to a mother and a child. But I was fortunate enough to stay with my mom up until I was 14. I can remember down at the creek, that's what we call them, Short Creek. I apologize, it's pronounced creek, by the way. And I can remember we had a very structured family. We'd get up in the morning at 5 o'clock. We'd have family class at 6, then we'd go eat breakfast with my dad. We'd all try to get closest to him, because he'd sit down on the table with a big calendar and write out each of the mother's names and the children that they were assigned to. And so we would sit there, and like if we had money, it would have, I guess, been called lobbying, but we'd try to advocate for specific chores that we felt like we wanted to do or didn't want to do. And so I can remember that. And then summers were my favorite thing there. After breakfast at 7 o'clock or so, we'd go do chores. We'd do a break at 10 o'clock, work till lunch, then do another break like 3 o'clock, and then we get off our chores, and then we get to go be with our birth mothers. And so at that point, my dad somewhat advocated for allowing children to be with their birth mothers to develop that connection, and this only lasted for about 3 years. We did a My dad would always do what he would do at best breakfast all year, and that's basically where we got to eat unhealthy for the only time in a year. So we got cereal and bacon, because usually it was just like oats and fruit, and which I'm grateful for at this point, but back then I was pretty dismayed. Now I'm trying to get back to oats and fruit. So that was some of my I really liked having a normal family. To me, is what it felt like. It was, we had the bond. I felt like my brothers and sisters from other mothers were my brothers and sisters, and it felt like a wonderful family to me. Until my grandpa died. And by that time, my dad had wedged his way up as the first counselor, which is automatically he became the successor to my grandpa. And as soon as he took over, he gradually, he was the first one in, I don't know, over 100 years to receive a revelation in our church. And we thought that was amazing at the time. But what he was doing was he was setting up the stepping stones for him to start giving any revelation that he felt necessary. So by the year 2003, he had stopped all general meetings and told the people that it was a curse because they had treated him improperly. Painted himself as a victim. And so, being that there were no meetings, there wasn't a lot of communication directly from the prophet to the people. And so he was able to start doing things much more secretly. He started disappearing for weeks at a time. He set up a night watch at our house, which we basically set up all of the mothers. By this time, we had around 65 moms, and he'd set up a network, basically having them rotate each night, telling us that apostates were after us, apostates were trying to kill him, and he would call us. He would be gone for weeks at a time, then he would call in, and he would tell us that the evil forces were outside the house, right outside. There were apostates, or there were demons that had been seen on the property, dressed in black, trying to harm us. And so we were absolutely mortified. He had us board up all of the windows. I don't know if anybody that went to that house, you may still see some of the boards there. We boarded up all of the windows, and I remember one Sunday my dad told us that there was an apostate that had a gun, and he was outside the gate, and he was trying to kill my dad. So that was the first time we all went on complete lockdown. About November, not about, November 29th, 2003, we still functioned as a family, somewhat. Well, actually not. We did function as a family. We still had, our chores and all the same stuff, but times were starting to feel very dark to me. And November 29th, 2003, my dad, we had a big basketball court and plenty of, toys to play with at the time. And my dad, basically, we had a big family day, just like, big dinner. We played with the family, lots of games. And then at the end of the day, my dad called everybody in. And he says, "I want everybody to go to their rooms and don't come out till tomorrow morning." And this was strange to us, but he's the prophet, so he'll do as he says. So we go to our rooms, and we don't come out until tomorrow morning. I came out in the morning, and you can imagine a house full of that many kids, and it's a freaking beehive. Because we're all under one roof, and there's a limited amount of bathrooms, so, and half of us wet the bed, so that didn't help at all. So it was usually very noisy in the mornings. So we came out of our room, and it was completely quiet. And I was like, what is going on? So I went to my mother's room, because usually we would go to our birth mother's room, and we would, brush our teeth, comb our hair, get ready for the day. We went to my mother's room, and it was completely quiet in there, too. And I found my mother, and her eyes were bloodshot. Sorry. I said, where's Trish and Grulin? She says they're gone. My dad had received a revelation that he was to test his wives and see what they were made of. He was to take their children away from him. His second wife had just recently been diagnosed with breast cancer. And he said the Lord told him to take 8 years old and younger. And while the worst feeling I've ever had in the world is seeing my mother hurt. And she couldn't stop crying. Nothing like this had ever happened to us before. We had just counted on. It was almost a little bit worse than death, because it was like a black hole. You didn't know if you were ever going to see him again. You're told that they were worthy and you weren't. And while my mother's tears were very painful to me to watch, it was even more painful to see my dad's second wife, because she had just been diagnosed with cancer and she didn't know if she was going to live. She ended up dying 6 months later. So that was our first, I feel like, a huge blow to our, emotional stability, where that was where it just really started to feel like we didn't know what was going to happen next. And it started to be, we live in constant fear. I hated going to bed every night because I didn't know if I was going to wake up in the morning and more people would be gone. So eventually my dad had us shipped off to, taken from the Jeff's block, shipped. He eventually isolated me specifically for some reason. And he would call me and tell me, you're the only one of my children not worthy to be in Zion, which we called the place that everybody that was worthy had gone. He would call me repeatedly and tell me that. And I don't understand the reason that he did what he did. I don't understand the reason that he singled me out from the time I was a kid. But that's what happened, and while it's painful, it's also, I'm somewhat grateful for it, because I don't feel like I would be here today if he hadn't treated me so horribly. So it went on for about a year, 2 years. My dad would call me, tell me I'm the only one of his children that's not worthy to go to Zion. And eventually, 2 years later, so when we went to hiding, he had sent us with some of his other wives. So we were at a house in hiding with like six or seven of his wives. And I grew some, even then I was still living in constant fear, because even some of them I grew very attached to. And I would go to bed crying every night because I thought that they were going to be gone in the morning, which I should have brought a letter that I wrote to my dad about. But about 2 years later, then my dad called us and told us that we should prepare to go. We should pack up our things, be ready to go somewhere. We didn't know where. And we get in the car, and he calls us and has us take these covenants that he calls the covenants of the United Order, which is basically the first two commandments that you promise to obey. And it's in what he told us, it was considered if you don't keep those covenants, there are drastic consequences. So it basically he placed us under those covenants, had us listen to a training, and it finally hit me that we were going to Zion. And I was very confused because I didn't understand how I was suddenly worthy, because I had like just recently thought of boobs. And so I was terrified on my way down to Texas. I was terrified that he was going to know if I thought any evil thoughts, especially because I was like seeing Gentiles on my way down there. And so I was trying not to look out the windows because, you know. And so we get down there, and my dad, he came and visited me a lot. He was there at Texas, which was pretty rare because usually he was, you know, off traveling somewhere in hiding. And he was there in Texas, and he would come visit me. I went, you know, and he started to show, you know, it felt like he was starting to want a little bit of a relationship with me. I can remember him coming down to my room and teaching me how to shave. He would bring me like pie and stuff. So it was like, wow, you know, this is turning out good. But then I was terrified that he knew what I was thinking. And I show up down there, and there's a lot of young women my age, some I went to school with, some were that were in grades just younger than me. And I'm 14 at the time. Some, the youngest one there was 11, and I was, you know, like, what are all these girls doing here? And he said, these are my wives. And kind of blew my mind a little bit, but me being the age that I was, you know, I'm fine with girls in the house. And so I started to, you know, obviously a 14-year-old kid, he's got plenty of hormones. And so I started, you know, having these temptations, I guess, towards my dad's wives that were 12 years old, and I'm 14. And I would confess them to my dad because I wanted to be completely honest. And then, so I would write to my dad, confess my, you know, evil thoughts. And he would, and then he would give me a revelation saying the Lord told him what I had just told him. Now, I didn't realize this until after I left, but it finally struck me the reason he knew everything in my life is because I was telling him. And that's why I thought he could read my mind. But I guess the way of taking advantage of a little kid. But So he 3 weeks later, that only lasted for 3 weeks, and I guess he must have really felt the competition in the house or something, because he had me sent away 3 weeks later. And that was one of the most terrible experiences of my life, because I had been with my mother up to this point, and he said she was worthy to stay, but I was not. So he had me shipped, and he had got arrested within those 3 weeks, so kudos to him. But he got arrested, and the first thing he did was call from prison and publicly humiliate me by telling me in front of the whole family, and mind you, this isn't just a few people, it's about 130 people, that I was no longer worthy to be there, and I was sent away. So I was shipped to a ranch up in Wyoming, out in the, about 40 miles west of Wyoming, or Wheatland. And I remember just crying for days, because it was the first time I had been completely separated from my mother with absolutely no contact whatsoever. And it was, I don't know, that was some of the hardest times of my life. Because everything that I had done with my mother, like we'd get up in the morning, we'd make breakfast together, we'd read together, we had grown very close doing everything together, and suddenly she was gone, and doing all of these things made me miss her a lot. But I felt guilty for that. And reading some of my letters that I had written to my dad, I felt very guilty for missing my mother. But that went on for about 8 months. And so just I feel like I might run out of time here, but so just so it's a, I don't know what, my dad had told me on the condition for me to go to Texas was for me to not masturbate. And so I told him, I had stopped, which I did. But this was the first time that it hit me that maybe he wasn't so inspired. Because when I was up in Wyoming, I started masturbating like a month before he called me and commended me for how good I'd been. And I was like, I thought you were inspired. Like, I thought. And so that was the first time it kind of hit me. I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, you've been telling me not to do this. I started doing it. Now you're, you know. So that was the first time that, I don't know, it kind of hit me that had happened. But since we're a little low on time, basically I'll just give a quick summary. So this separation went on for a while. I eventually got to be back with my mother for a time, got re-separated again, went through, I ended up getting to go back with the family. And because when I got to go back with the family, it was at the First Presidency's behest, I guess. They're the ones that said that I could. And in my family's mind, my dad had to say that I could. Otherwise, it wasn't by revelation. So when I was there, then my older brothers, and it eventually spread to my younger brothers and some of the rest of the family, they concluded that I wasn't supposed to be there because I hadn't been named by my dad. So I finally get to be back with the family after all these years, and they didn't want me. Nobody wanted me to be there. So I took it at great relief when, a relief but also very humiliated, because my dad sent me back to Short Creek, which was considered a great curse or punishment for a prophet's son to have to be with the common people. I'm sorry. Yes, it's a very patriarchal I don't know, hierarchical, I guess. But I took it at great relief, and the reason he had sent me away is because I had discovered porn. And I found out that female anatomy was different than male anatomy, which I thought it was the same for 18 years of my life. So I confessed that to him, and he sent me to Short Creek. And eventually, he sent me out to work, which was even a greater condemnation because you couldn't even be with the people who were considered unworthy to be in Zion. So I was out working for a couple of years. And it just grew more and more distant. My dad kept pushing me away. I would never hear from him, maybe once every 6 months. And it would only be, if you don't repent, you're going to, it's just like you're going to hell. You're going to hell. Every time I talked to him, this is your last chance. This is your last chance. So I started trying to do stuff, like buy a phone, watch porn, watch movies. Trying to do stuff and then confessing it to get him to kick me out, but he wouldn't, which I feel like is very hypocritical because he was kicking everybody else out. And because I didn't want the taint of being an apostate. But it came to a point where I still firmly believe my dad, but it came to a point where I was like, I'm going to die anyway. The harder I try, the worse it gets. Like, my dad just keeps pushing me away. He's hell-bent on pushing me away. And so I made a decision. I was over in Des Moines, Iowa, on a job site, and I had bought a phone. I basically gave them an ultimatum a month earlier, telling them that if they didn't pay me, I was going to go find another job. And so I had bought a phone, found a ticket on Expedia for $160. And I've been thinking about leaving for years, but I wanted to see my mother again. Because, mind you, at this point, I hadn't seen her or talked to her in 2 years. Because my dad had forbidden it. So I was at the job site, and I was just like, This is where my impulsiveness, I feel like, was beneficial. It rarely is, but I was like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this right now. Like, I was like, it was kind of a funny conversation. I was like, you're really doing this? I was like, yeah, I'm doing it. And so I walked down, we're in downtown Des Moines, building a hotel. And I walked down to the toolbox and locked up my tools, and I took off running. And I could hear my mom crying because I knew my dad would use it against her and tell her she was a failure because of how she had raised me, and that he was right after all these years. But in my mind, it was like either I live in here and, be destroyed when the judgments come, or I go out there and maybe have a little bit of a life, have a little bit of fun in my life before I die, which I figured was, bound to happen within a year or so. And I remember riding on the plane terrified that God was going to strike it down, because I thought, for sure my dad knew that I had just left. He was going to ask God to, send some lightning our way or something. So I made that jump. I made that step, which I feel like was the best step I ever made. I didn't realize what the world was. I didn't realize what I was in for as far as experiences. It's been a very tough. I feel like some of the toughest experiences in my life have been since I left, because it was an extreme culture shock, and I didn't know anything about this world out here, and I had to find it all out, kind of take a big crash course. And so it's been a tough ride, but through, you know, a couple of her through a suicide attempt, through a lot of depression, but a lot of counseling and some amazing people in my life, I'm still here today. I'm very grateful for it. And my hope and my dream is to be able to see my mom again. That's what I'm living for. And with that, I believe we're open for Q&A. Thank you.
Roy, I did have a couple of quick questions, and first of all, I probably speak for everybody in this room that you're extremely courageous, and we're glad you're here. To your knowledge, has your father been diagnosed officially with any kind of mental illness? And the second question, is there an official way in the FLDS Church to resign or not?
I do not know. Basically, his medical situation is kept very private within the prison system, and we're not. Like, I don't have any communication with him unless he wants it. And I wouldn't get any access to any of that information unless he wanted me to have that access. And as far as resigning, yes, you can, but you risk losing your family, losing everything, if you so much as say, I question the prophet.
My question is, you said that your greatest desire is to have contact with your mother. Do you know of her whereabouts? And if so, have you attempted to contact her? Do you know her feelings about you and if she knows anything about your life today?
I do not know her whereabouts, and that's one of the most, terrifying things to me, is to not know where she is, if she's okay. As far as ways to contact her, she's being in hiding under my dad's control. You don't have any electronics, like zero. You can't even have an iPod, which is very confusing to me because it can't even connect to the internet. So he basically removes all communication whatsoever. And so the only way I would be able to know or find out where she is to get word through the leaders, which I've attempted before, and no response. So, and when you leave, they completely disown you. My dad called around and told everyone that I was no longer his son, and they were no longer to call me brother or son. And I know from what I hear from what my sisters told me after I left, my mom she can't hear my name. If she hears my name, she's in tears. And that hurts.
Roy, I have had a little more experience probably than most of the people here with the FLDS, including taking your father's deposition. he is a unique combination of mental illness.
Loves
and
the Fifth Amendment, right?
Loves the Fifth Amendment. He took the Fifth Amendment to every question. And really this kind of power-driven evil. And I is commend you so much for having the courage to get out, and I do hope that you'll see your mother again. Regarding this question, my understanding is that during the legal process involving Warren Jeffs, he was given a psychological evaluation. So I'm pretty sure that he has been diagnosed with a mental illness, but it's sealed, so it's nobody really knows it.
Yeah.
But my question is, I'm wondering about your sisters. It sounds like you've had contact with them, so I'm guessing that they are out, and I'd like to know if you have, what kind of relationship you have with them, and whether they, not being the wicked man that you are, are still able to talk to their, to your mother.
No, they don't. They don't. They may have a little more contact than I do, but they are my sisters. I was my dad's fourth son, 11th child, and they're all quite a bit older than me. So I never really did have a relationship with them before, and it hasn't, you know, and maybe it will in the future, but so far nothing has really developed. And these are all my half-sisters. I only have one sister that's full-blooded. She's younger than me.
Is she still in?
Yes.
In a patriarchal society, sons are more valued than daughters. And I'm wondering if you have had contact or any relations with your brothers, even if they're from the other mothers.
So, yes, I mean, I've only had contact with the other ones that have left, which I've had two brothers that have left. But the patriarchal society in there is very strange in that the men are valued more for authority, but the women are valued more for members. So he'll kick out 100 men, you know, to save one woman, I guess. This is kind of the mentality that he has. So he feels like he values women a lot more, but he also values men for their hierarchy.
Thank you for sharing. Very touching. Is there a network of support from people who have left? And what psychological dynamics keep people so hooked in to something, at least to us on the outside, seems so hurtful and crazy? I don't mean that disrespectfully,
yeah.
But...
So the psychological thing, our whole group was born and raised in this. This mentality of destructions and judgment was ingrained in us from the time we were born. And that's all that we knew. And it's a lot of it also, they're able, the tools that they have, a lot of it comes from persecution, supposed persecution against the people, which I think is a massive mistake by outside society, is coming at it from a legal perspective and trying to criminalize it, because that only gives them tools to drive into us that because we're being persecuted, that therefore we are the true church, and that's basically gives legitimacy to their claim by the criminalization of it, which I feel like is a whole other topic. But they do not allow members to be converted. Everybody that's been, there's very few that are still there that have been converted. And that happened back in the 60s and 70s. But nowadays, in order for my dad to do what he's doing it with a group of mostly young people that have been born in the 80s, 90s, and he was able to ingrain this stuff into from the time they're a child. So, I mean, you think of, like, how Nazis were able to do such terrible things. And a lot of it was because they were raised from the time they were kids to do what they did. And that's the same thing. Like, it was ingrained into us. We didn't know anything different. And that's why I say I'm grateful my dad treated me the way he did, because if he wouldn't have, I would still be there. Just like most of my brothers that are still there. I would still be in there I'm faithfully defending him and willing to die for him.
Is there a support network of people who have left that you get together and support each other?
In regard to your question about the support network, there is several different groups. But I feel like a lot of groups go at it with the wrong mentality. They want to rescue rather than help. And that's where I want to start a conversation that is addressing, you know, informing people like me to come out. And so it's that there is groups. There's a Holding Out Help that Tanya Toole has. There's a few different groups that are helping with the physical, you know, helping people with housing, and they helped me. I came out for a couple of months. And so, yes, there is groups, but I feel like that subject needs to be readdressed to, rather than rescue, inform, help. So,
what were Warren's words and attitudes towards LDS? And did he consider LDS as being simply part of the larger Christian community? Or did he feel a sense of safety if his exiting children somehow fell under the arms of LDS rather than some other group? Was there more or less disdain about the LDS because it was a kind of cousin?
I believe it would have been more disdain because he considered what we were taught, again, from the time we were kids, what we were taught is the LDS Church is completely Gentile and apostate. And we were taught that in the year 1978, when Spencer W. Kimball allowed black people into the church, that was the point that God forsook it completely. And so that's what we were taught as kids growing up. And so the LDS Church was almost worse because it was like you had been given the greater light, but you were blatantly going back to, you know, this lesser light, this lesser gospel. And so it wouldn't have given him any safety. They were considered just as bad as the rest of the world, if not worse.
Thanks everyone for your participation. This ends this session. Let's give a round of applause for Roy.
Thank you.